Hello and welcome to another episode of Talking with the Wounded with me, your host, Ben Stevens. Today, in this episode, we're going a little bit off-piste in that this is the first one we've ever done where nobody in the room is wounded. But I think that the subject will be of interest to you as it's all around the treatment of PTSD and at the cutting edge of that. So I think we're just going to dive straight in with my guest today, who's very kindly agreed to let me ask him a number of questions about something that I know nothing about, but he knows an awful lot about. And that is with a chap called Dr. Ian Jordan, who runs the psychedelic clinical trials at a place called the Clerkenwell Health Clinic. Is that right?
That is all correct.
Great. Welcome. And thank you for having me. Ian, why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about Clerkenwell Health and psychedelic clinical trials for the treatment of PTSD?
Sure. So Clerkenwell Health is Europe's first specialist psychedelic research organisation, and it was set up a couple of years ago because it is a very specialist area requiring a certain expertise in around the setup of trials and how they happen and what happens when people are being dosed with psychedelics and the setting. So this is why our rooms look like this. So the founders really identified that there was a gap in the market, that traditional clinical research couldn't handle the kind of complexity of psychedelic clinical trials. So that's how it came about.
Psychedelic science, this is the use of what we might call psychedelic drugs, euphoria-enhancing drugs, all available on the street illegally or wherever it is you might normally get them, and using them in a scientific way because of the actual properties of those drugs and some of the things they do. So which drug are we talking about? And talk us through, why is this an area of interest?
Yeah, so psychedelic drugs as a class describe, people use the term slightly different ways. So generally when people say psychedelics, they're talking about drugs that cause a very unusual experience. So a very intensely emotional experience that can be positive or negative, and typically visual experiences, and sometimes very profound existential experiences. So most people are talking about LSD, magic mushrooms, which is psilocybin, is the active compound, DMT. So that's what people usually mean when they say psychedelic. There's a slightly broader definition that includes things like MDMA and methadone. So MDMA is, people will know as ecstasy. So that is a drug that has been around since the 60s. People will know that it's sold on the street. People use it as a party drug.
That's a euphoric sort of inducing.
Yeah, exactly. That causes an intensely pleasurable experience. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit different. So you don't get the kind of hallucinations and the bad trips, or challenging experiences that you get with the other kind of psychedelics.
Okay. So which is the one that you're using in your trials?
So we use a number of different ones, actually. So we're using psilocybin. We're using 5-MeO-DMT, which people might have heard of. Licking the toad. You ever heard of that?
Yeah. Licking the toad.
There's an Amazonian toad.
Ah, right. Okay.
Yeah, that has, in the glands on its back, it has an extremely potent hallucinogen. People go off and people...
Who
licked the toad first?
This is
one of the big questions of human discovery. Who ate the mushrooms? Who licked the toad?
I get the mushrooms.
I don't know.
Who's the first? But whoever went, do you know what? If we lick this toad, we might get a bit of a rush from it. I mean, how many other animals had they licked?
Well, who looked at a cow and said, I'm going to drink whatever comes out of that? I guess
it's... I guess. licking it... Okay. But somebody in the jungle must have done it somewhere.
Well, there's an even more interesting question, just as an interesting aside, which is people might have heard of ayahuasca. People go on ayahuasca retreats to the Amazon.
Right.
Now, ayahuasca is a brew that's made with the vines of an Amazonian tree that contains DMT, which is another very, very potent hallucinogen. But somehow, over the centuries and millennia, someone discovered that if you drink that brew, nothing happens. But if you mix it with the brew of another plant, the other plant has a chemical in it, which is very like our modern antidepressants, that allows your body to absorb that. And it's such an unlikely combination, but somehow someone discovered it.
Okay. We're
off track.
We're off track. Those are the drugs you use, that you mentioned earlier. And these are drugs which do what to the brain? Why are they particularly useful when dealing with somebody's PTSD?
So a couple of ways of thinking about it. So you could think in terms of what it does to the brain, or you could think about what it does to the mind, right? So there is, I mean, obviously the brain comes out of the mind, but there are slightly different ways of thinking about it. So we have hypotheses about both. And I can tell you, when it comes to PTSD treatment, we have quite good hypotheses from talking to patients about what happens. So, and here I'm talking about MDMA and methylone.
Yeah.
So PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, is quite a specific kind of syndrome or collection of symptoms that happens after life-threatening trauma. So it has to be something really kind of intensely terrifying. And the constellation of symptoms are, you know, they're kept going. It's like a loop of symptoms that are self-reinforcing, like most mental disorders, but it's a very tightly kind of self-reinforcing loop. And all of the treatments for PTSD that we have available now are some form of exposure therapy. So I think probably the best way to think about PTSD, and there are different ways of thinking about it, is that it's a phobia to a memory. And now a phobia is something that causes a very intense fear response in the body. So if you have a phobia of dogs, if you see a dog across the street, you go into panic mode, fight or flight, you run away. Now you can treat that fairly easily, right, with gradual exposure to, you know, dogs.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is, the phobia. Very hard to do to something that lives inside your brain. So PTSD, if it's a phobia to a memory, it means anytime you come close to thinking about that thing that happened. So it was the bomb that killed your friend, or your friend being shot in front of you, or you being attacked and assaulted. Anytime you even start to think about that, or you dream about it, your whole body goes into fight or flight.
So the purpose of the drugs is to stop that, it inhibits that fear receptor in the brain, allows you to visit it without having all those symptoms.
Yes,
is that
exactly so the treatment is exposure. So the treatment is to gradually allow the person to start thinking about, talking about, remembering what happened to them without the body kind of completely going. So at the
so
end,
like
of,
a deep dive into that trauma
yeah.
inducing moment.
So what your body needs to learn is everything's safe right now, because what your body thinks is you're back in the Hummer.
Uh-huh.
You're back on the battlefield.
Yeah.
But you're not. But your body doesn't know that. So what exposure therapy does is it just gradually teaches your body that everything's safe. So you can remember, talk about, think about. Because you can't stop remembering things, you know. So it means that people are what people do is they avoid the whole world. They avoid anything that reminds them of their traumatic experience. But that becomes a very small life very quickly.
If I was part of the trial, let's say, I'm coming to this establishment, this lovely, calm space here at the clinic.
Yeah.
And is that where I'm taking the drug before I mean, you're the doctor that might give me the drug, but you're not the one I'm then seeing my psychotherapist.
Right. So our studies work here is, people come in, they go through the whole screening procedure, which is very extensive. And then if we, number one, diagnose that they have PTSD, and number two, that they're safe to take part, because these are early stage studies, so this huge safety requirements. So young, healthy people, typically.
Sorry, just to say, clinical trials, I mean, this is managed by the British Medical Board somebody?
There's so many different regulatory bodies. So there's the MHRA, which is Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory, and then...
But it's a massively regulated...
Enormous, yeah. So we've got, like, my professional body, the GMC, you've got the MHRA, you've got an ethics committee, and so on and so forth. And these are Schedule 1 drugs, right? These are illegal drugs with no... What Schedule 1 means is they have no medical benefit currently, according to the law. So there's a locked room down there. It's like a cage. It's places like Fort Knox. And I have to have a special license to prescribe those.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the whole thing is
locked down. This is a junkie's
dream.
Yeah.
No way you could get into this building, or at least into the pharmacy. So, yeah, people come in then on dosing day. They've met the therapist,
uh-huh.
who's a trial therapist, and they take the medication with MDMA or methylone.
Uh-huh.
It takes effect in like 30 to 60 minutes.
Okay.
And as you say, what it does is it sort of switches off the fear response. So the part of the brain that mediates that fear response is called the amygdala. And so it turns down the whole fear response. So then, because that's what makes therapy difficult, right?
Because if your whole body explodes into a fight or flight every time you think about it or talk about it, you know, it's very difficult.
You can't visit it and explore it. So, what was the name of the amygdala?
The amygdala, yeah.
That's a little part of the brain where fear
that's
comes
right.
from.
Yeah, it's the way station in the brain where all your thoughts and memories and sensations go to be processed, and your brain decides whether it's safe or interesting or important, you know, so it's salience.
Is it keeper or not?
Yeah, so is it sex? Is it food? Is it danger? So the amygdala decides all of that and then tells you how to respond. And it's all automatic. And so that's why all these bodily responses are just bang in the second automatic. Because you don't want to have to think about whether something's dangerous. You want to get the...
Yeah, you want that response.
Exactly.
So you're dialing down that sort of phobia to the memory, I suppose, is it?
That's the idea. That fear response, you are significantly dialing that down. And then people sit there on the bed or on the chair here and they talk for a 6-hour therapy session. Talk with the therapist about whatever it is that they want to talk
about. With the drugs
in their
slowly
system.
Weaning off maybe. But
it's a duration of effect of around 4 hours and then starts to wean off. Yeah, so people are in that state of feeling very safe. It also enhances kind of a sense of connection with other people. If you talk to people who go to parties and take ecstasy, that's where they feel intensely socially connected with other people. And one of the most important mediators of therapy effectiveness is that you have an alliance with your therapist, that you feel a rapport, that you feel safe, connected, that you like them, you trust them.
So the therapy happens and the therapist is saying that because the patient has taken this drug, they are able to really drill down further into the moment. I mean, their response to it and their fears, because the patient isn't clamming up and going, I don't want to go there.
Yeah, exactly. So the patient, like with all exposure therapies, if the patient or client or whatever you want to call the person guides the speed of exposure, that works best. So the hypothesis here is, because we're turning down that whole thing, and people are here for treatment, right? They want to get better. These are people with very high PTSD scores.
Yeah.
Their lives have become unlivable.
Yeah, difficult to probably even get them here out of their own houses.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And we even before we enroll them, we ask them like hours and hours of questions about the terrible things that have happened to them. And that can make people exhausted after an 8-hour training day. So during the therapy session, around 6 hours, they talk about whatever it is they want to talk about. But people go there pretty quickly, right? Because that's why they're here.
Yeah.
And they talk about what happened. And there's a lot of shame and guilt associated with PTSD usually. Right? So that might be survivor guilt. All your buddies were killed.
Yeah.
It might be, I should have done more. All of that stuff. And so it's not just the fear response. It's all of the stuff that's wrapped up in that. When your brain is in a constant state of emergency.
Could I have done this?
Could I have done this?
I let the side down, all of those things.
All that stuff, yeah.
So typically how many sessions? Is this a sort of thing that you do every week for a couple of months and then suddenly, because I've been so deep, I now know how to manage it when I'm not under the influence?
Yeah.
Is that,
what was the
process?
That's the idea. So these trials have been done, a lot of them by an organization called MAPS in the US. So it's a multidisciplinary association for psychedelic studies. And they, a lot of work with veterans, and we use a similar protocol to them. So it's 4 sessions, a week apart.
Okay.
And we have seen that people can get better very quickly. One of the problems with protocolized clinical trials is that it's just 4, then you're gone. That's it. So, I mean, it only takes a second's reflection to know that some people are going to need 1. Some people are going to need 4. Some people are going to need a lot more, depending on the type of person, how bad the trauma was, how entrenched it is, what kind of a person they are, you know? So it's a real problem, and it's not a question we know the answer to yet. We're terrible at personalizing medicine generally. You go to your doctor and you get what the thing says. So the big dream, my big dream for psychiatry, is that we can be personalized. We can say, here's what you particularly need at this particular moment with your particular problem. And we don't really have that right now. So in answer to your question, people get 4 weeks on our trials. And we have seen in the open label study, which means that everybody knows what they're getting and everyone gets the active treatment, very rapid and dramatic reductions in symptoms.
Okay, you are getting a positive
response. And there are, you know, later stage results from these studies in the US that do show a robust and significant reduction in symptoms.
Okay.
So,
and this is something that some other countries have already, what's the phrase, legalized, or their medical boards have said, yep, you can do it. I mean, I think you were talking previously, just before Australia.
Yeah, so Australia, just a few months ago, said that psilocybin, so that's what's in magic mushrooms for depression, and MDMA for PTSD can now be given by doctors in medical clinics with therapy.
Yeah.
So this is another big open question, right? Do you just give the medications or do you give them with therapy? And at the moment, we believe that they need to be given in the context of therapy so that they catalyze therapy rather than, it's not like an antidepressant, you just take it and, you know.
Off you go back home.
Yeah. So yeah, Australia has legalized, but we don't, you know, very early days there, we don't know what that's gonna look like. And then Canada and Switzerland have provisions where in rare cases, people with very refractory or treatment resistant problems can get those from specifically licensed people. And the US the FDA is gonna make a decision towards the end of this year.
FDA?
Yeah, the Food and Drug Administration in the US. So it's like our MHRA. They make all the decisions about whether drugs get licensed. And they are expected to make a decision about MDMA specifically for PTSD in October.
Okay. How long does a trial, what's the timeline look like before this hopefully gets the tick in the box and becomes a something that somebody with PTSD can be,
go to the doctor and get
prescribed.
So if everything goes well in the US, that could be towards the end of the year. And in there's a provision now post-Brexit where if the FDA licenses something that in pretty short order, the MHRA can do that.
Oh.
So
everybody believes in each other's medicine.
Well, that's right. We're all friends now. Well, I'm Irish.
Regardless of Europe.
So
we're all friends.
We are I grew up in the 70s, but we are now all friends. So the
I spent most of my soldier game there. So.
Oh yeah.
I know where you're coming from.
Yeah. So the most optimistic timeline is that we would early 2025 MDMA could be prescribed for PTSD, and maybe later that year or early the next year psilocybin for depression, because those trials look pretty good as well. Not as good as the MDMA for PTSD ones.
Okay, so that's faster than I thought. Yeah. I mean, that's not a million miles away.
Yeah.
And so let's just rewind a little bit about PTSD itself. Not everybody who experiences the same traumatic event has the same response.
That's right.
And somebody can end up with, you know, me and my team can all go through the same incidents and lots of them, and three of us crack on with our lives and are fine, and one isn't.
Yeah, that's right.
So I guess what I'm really asking is, why does he get it and nobody else? Is that when we're all there in the same event, we all watch the same thing go bang, or the same person get shot, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Why?
So you're right, about 17% of people after the kind of trauma that we talk about when we talk about PTSD get PTSD. Actually, a commoner outcome is depression and other types of anxiety and alcohol use and all those kind of things. So those are more common. Why does a person develop PTSD? Well, there are a few different reasons, and they all interact. So for instance, if the person is temperamentally more inclined to be danger sensitive, right? So there's lots of different terms you might use to describe that. And that's a good thing, right? That's an evolved, adaptive thing. You know, the anxious bunny survives, as one of the therapists I know says. So, and there's always a balance in your neurology, the way your brain is, between approach behaviors, where you go towards things that you want, and avoidance or retreat behaviors.
Uh-huh.
And some people, everyone's got different, like a graphic equalizer, everyone's got slightly different settings.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're tendency is to kind of, you know, escape from danger, you have a more of a risk for all mental disorders. So that's been called various things over the years, high trait neuroticism, you know, sensitivity, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
So that's one factor that some people are more inclined because of the way their brain is.
Yeah.
Then there are other factors. So for instance, you know, the severity and number of traumas, the how you think about and recall it afterwards. So I worked in Oxford for 10 years as a consultant there, treating people on the major trauma ward, the surgical ward.
At the John Radcliffe? At
John Radcliffe.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a lot of veterans up there, right? And so I worked with a lot of people who'd been through road traffic accidents, veterans, you know, all experiences that can give you PTSD. And we did prevention work with people. And one of the things you notice in the days after something like you've seen someone get shot, or you've been shot at, or there's been a bomb, it's normal and desired and expected to be on your guard, right? I don't need to tell you this, right? Yep. Your body's tensed up, you don't sleep, because sleep is risky, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And your adrenaline is up, you notice everything, you jump at a noise. So that's good, that's normal.
Yeah.
So if one of the ways of thinking about this is it is a normal experience that gets extended too long. Right, so you're in that state that you're in for the hours or days following the trauma.
Hypervigilant.
Yeah. But you're in it for a year, 5 years, 10 years, instead of 3 days.
Yeah.
And how does that happen? Well, we have a theory about how it happens related to, which is a little bit like how phobias develop. So if after your event, right, when you're back in safety, when you think about it and remember it, what do you do, right? Do you kind of play it over in your mind and kind of think about it, you know, and you're calm and you sort of explore what happened and you're able to think about it. It's painful, but you're able to kind of think about it. You're able to talk about it. That's one route you go down. If you do that, you're probably okay.
Yeah.
But if you, every time it kind of comes up for you a little bit, you kind of clench your body against it and you like get up and you walk away or you suppress the memory or you drink to try and get rid of it. All of those behaviors, what you're kind of doing is you're saying to the memory, if you like, this is not safe, I'm getting out of here. And uh-huh. So and over time, you're this is where that little kind of self-reinforcing feedback loop happens.
Yeah.
What your brain and your body start to learn is that it's not safe to even think about it, to even remember it. And so, and that's how the little PTSD loop starts.
And you keep pushing it down, it becomes harder and harder to do, you reach for stronger and stronger
ways of avoidance. So you stop going out, because going out, you see people remind you of the people who shot at you. You stop going down crowded streets because they're noisy and you can't tell what's safe. And there is a sort of there's a very good first principle of how minds work, which is if you avoid it or you push it away, it will chase you. That's true of anything that we do. It doesn't matter how strong. One of the things about soldiers is soldiers have been taught and trained to deal with hard things, right?
Yeah.
And they suddenly come up against an enemy in PTSD. The harder you fight it, the stronger it gets. So it's not like any other situation, which is the harder you fight it, the more you kill it, the more you get over it. The harder you fight it, the stronger it gets.
And so let it take you.
Let it take you. Yeah, it's the opposite, right? You let it take you. You lie there. And you let it, the feeling hit your body, and you get through it, and you're okay.
Yeah.
And that's the opposite, I think, of the way most people fight the world.
Well, and and the enemy. What you've been.
Interesting that the person with PTSD who gets it and the others don't, is that also because of potentially what you were doing in the aftermath of the incident? In terms of, I'm thinking of policemen who are turning up to road traffic accidents all the time,
mm-hmm.
go through their whole career with no PTSD or whatever, because as they arrive at the scene, as horrific it can be, they're in job mode, they're in work mode, they've got things to think about.
That's right.
Traffic, safety, secure this, secure that, block that off. That, you know, their mind is lots of jobs, mm-hmm. bit like as a soldier, as a commander or responsible for others, you've got jobs to do.
Yep.
It's gone bang. It's up to you to organize whatever the response is, whether that's medical, whether that's chasing the enemy, whether that's calling in. You've got things to do. You've got to tell people about it. You're on the radio. There's conversations happening. You're moving your chess pieces around the battlefield. For the guy standing there next to his friend who is at the, I don't want to say the bottom of the rung, but you know, he's the grunt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's waiting for instructions, and in the aftermath, he's like, you know, kneeling on a street corner, pointing his rifle down the road.
Yeah.
Contemplating just what happened.
Yeah.
and he hasn't got a job to do. He hasn't been given a job yet. Yeah. So therefore, is he then more, he's more susceptible because he gets to think about it, whereas the rest of us are in work mode.
Yeah. So two things that are super important, and you're exactly right. So the first is, if you have a sense of powerlessness, or a sense that you're out of control, you can't influence the situation, you're more likely to develop PTSD. That feels kind of obvious, right? So that's another one of those multiple factors. That's really important. And so it's one of those things that feeds into it. The other thing is, in the aftermath, what happens? Do you have meaning and purpose? Are you busy? Because if you are, you're distracted, you're not thinking about the thing that happened, and you process it in the background. So I think people in the West particularly, we have this idea that if you have a problem, you should think about it. And that's actually usually a disaster.
I like this. Yeah. You've got a problem thinking about it.
It's disastrous. So actually, most of your problems you work out while you're busy thinking about something else, right?
Yeah.
That's why we say sleep on it. Because you can't think about it, right? Because it's too complicated. And your conscious brain has a processing speed of about 4 bits per second, right? In computer language. Your unconscious brain, 2 million. So if in the aftermath, you're helping your friends, doing logistics, escaping, maybe not escaping because you're still in the kind of danger. But if you have meaning and purpose and you're occupied, you're much less likely to develop PTSD. In Oxford, they did this amazing experiment where they got Game Boys with Tetris on them.
Right.
And they went into the emergency department, and anyone who'd come in with a major trauma, they gave them the Tetris to play with, and they kept it with them for a few days. And those people who were busy doing something a bit mindless, right? But your attention has a bandwidth of one item. You can pay attention to one thing at a time. Nobody can multitask. Women can task switch, but nobody can.
Careful.
Yeah, but they're task switching better than men are.
Yeah.
But they're not actually multitasking. They're just moving. So if you're paying attention to something, that's all you're paying attention to. So when they had the Tetris Game Boys and they were playing Tetris, they weren't remembering, recalling, going back to, pushing away, anything like that.
That was going on in the back.
It was going. Yeah, your brain was doing its job, which is to process what's happened to you and learn from it.
Yeah.
Instead of getting stuck in the kind of tightly reinforcing loop that's all common mental disorders are.
And as you alluded to earlier, trying to fight it actually makes it worse.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a perception, a lot of people have a perception that if you have a mental health problem, there's something weak about that, right? I mean, that's pretty obvious. But this is the one where the harder you fight it, the stronger it fights back. And the more tired you get, the more exhausted you get. And that's why people commit suicide.
Yeah, because that's the ultimate way of pushing it away, getting rid of it.
Because you have to, if you just pump adrenaline into somebody's body 24 hours a day, it's exhausting and awful. And people will try and make that stop.
So, are you recruiting people for trials?
We are, yeah.
And how does that work?
So, we advertise in lots of places online. So people hear about us, they go to the website, they register for trials, they say what kind of the nature of the problem that they have is. Most people with mental health problems have multiple. So if you have PTSD, you're probably depressed. If you have generalized anxiety disorder, you're probably depressed, etc. So people sign up. So we're recruiting for alcohol trials. So people are drinking too much, alcohol use problems, PTSD, depression, postnatal depression, bipolar.
Okay. So for our sort of predominantly military.
Yeah.
Well, not that our listeners are not they might be predominantly military, but talking with the wounded, we've had some guests with PTSD and talking through, you know, what led to that and their life thereafter and the charities that are looking after them. For people listening to this who might have a mate who's, you know, left or might still be serving, it's a question of just going to the website and then going on from there. So I'll put that all in the rider notes at the bottom of this.
ClarkandWellHealth.com.
ClarkandWellHealth.com. And then there's a whole process as to whether or not they actually qualify for the trial.
Yeah, exactly. So so for instance, if someone signs up and they tick PTSD, we'll then send a follow-up form, which is a PTSD form. And if based on that, we think they're eligible, give them a call and then bring them in for a screening day here on site.
One last thing.
Hmm.
This route that you're going down, versus the current way that it's dealt with. Is that because we're thinking the current method isn't working, or it's just it could be better, or is it just not actually, it's a sticky plaster and we've not got it right? What's the...
So kind of all of the above, I think. I worked in the NHS and Public Health Service in Ireland for 20 years, and I left because I didn't think I was helping people in the way I wanted to. So, and that's partly because the treatments we have aren't great. So think about antidepressants, for instance. On average, they move you about 1 point on a 40-point scale. Some people respond really well. Some people get worse or don't respond at all. And psychotherapies are similar. So the treatments we have are good, but they're not great. They're good for some people. We don't know how to tell who should get what. So I think things could definitely get better. And there's just an avalanche of suffering, you know, coming at us every day. There aren't enough people to treat it. There aren't enough treatments. There's not enough personalization. So all of this is part of like just exploring the space of possibility and what different things might help what different types of people. And in future, hopefully, kind of do precision psychiatry, you know, where you come and we figure out one way or another what you need now.
For you, personalized specifically with your...
with your particular problem, this particular day, and who's best placed to deliver it, you know?
Yeah.
Because one of the things I think people who go to see a therapist get very variable experience, you know, there's a huge variability in terms of quality, but no way to tell. Nobody measures that.
Yeah, and it's a subjective thing, right? Can be.
Well, it's subjective in the sense that like different people like different people, but it's objective in the sense that there are just measurably good therapists who get 10 times better outcomes, 10 times better outcomes than the bottom 10% of therapists. So it's pretty objective, actually. It's you can measure it.
Yeah. It could be the same for surgeons.
It is the same for surgeons, but we measure surgeons' outcomes. Like, you can't be a terrible surgeon. So like, eventually, you'll just get fired. You know?
if you keep screwing it up, somebody says, stop.
If you take off the wrong leg, you know, three times in a row, like, you know, there'll be an investigation.
Yeah.
We just don't en masse measure other types of healthcare professional that way. Like psychiatrists, like you know me. I might be terrible, I don't know, you know, but nobody measures me.
If people keep coming back for more would be one measure.
Yeah.
If nobody came back a second time, that might tell you you're in the wrong gig.
True to an extent, but people are desperate, you know?
Yeah.
People are desperate, so they will keep going back to someone who's terrible. Because they don't know. You know,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
The person might be kind of nice, but terrible at their job, but people might not be able to tell. It can be difficult to tell.
Yeah. Fascinating. I think that's probably quite a good place to leave it, Ian. Thank you very much for your time and for inviting me here and letting me quiz you about this kind of stuff and for putting it in what I hope is relatively understandable language for our listeners, because I know it can get a bit like when people talk about what they do in the army. It can be very technical, full of all sorts of acronyms, which are totally normal to all of us, but everyone else is sitting in the room going, what? So I think we've managed to avoid most of those. So I think we'll call it a day there. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
You have PTSD or know of somebody that has it and you're interested in becoming a part of this trial, if you go into the show notes, the link will be there where you can start the process described by Ian. I'll send you a form and take it from there. And I hope you didn't mind me going off-piste and not having anybody wounded on this podcast, but I thought it was of interest to most of you to hear what the late treatments are, etc., for something which we're seeing a lot more of amongst our veteran community. There'll be another episode out soon. I'm trying to get them out every couple of weeks in this series, but inevitably the day job and things can get in the way. But we are making progress. And thank you once again for your likes, for referring it onwards. And I look forward to bringing you another guest in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks very much.